for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Anger over the health care bill leads to an escalation of threats against lawmakers. Michael Steele tries to hold on to the chairmanship of the RNC, but Republicans fear a spending scandal will hurt their ability to pick up seats in the midterm elections. And Toyota faces a record fine for not coming clean sooner. Joining us for the domestic hour of our Friday news roundup, Ezra Klein of the Washington Post and Newsweek. Welcome to you.
Hello.
Good to have you with us. Melinda Henneberger of PoliticsDaily.com. Good morning.
Hi.
And Ross Douthat of the New York Times. Hello to you.
Hello, Diane.
And throughout the hour, we'll take your calls, your comments, questions. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also join us on Facebook or Twitter. So let's talk first about these latest efforts in the coal mine rescue. It looks not very good, Ezra.
No, it's a terrible situation, and you know we of course wish the rescuers all the luck, but it looks increasingly unlikely. And you know, I think the question from this is what comes next. There was a terrible mine disaster a number of years back, and Congress passed what it said was a historic mine safety legislation, and now it's coming out that the owner of these mines had just an endless
hundreds
list of violations, not only on this mine but on the dozens of other mines he operates, and nothing was being done. No, the front page of my paper today notes that he escaped any very stiff fines. So something is clearly broken down here.
Why is it that someone who's broken the law, not taken the care he should have with mine safety, why does he get away with it, Ross?
I mean, part of it is, you know, after a disaster happens, a lot of things become much clearer in hindsight, and you focus in on, you know, the particular set of violations that happened at this particular mine that this particular person was responsible for. I mean, in a weird way, we've seen a similar thing in the last couple of weeks, both in the conversation about Toyota and its safety problems and in the ongoing conversation about sex abuse in the Roman Catholic Church, where, you know, after a disaster happens, everybody looks back and says, well, you know, the regulators missed this, people covered up this, people should have done that, and so on. But some of this is the problem to which, you know, bureaucracies are heir. You pass a law, you have a set of rules, but people don't always follow them, and people are always going to find ways around them.
Melinda, you disagree.
Well, there were clearly loopholes in this 06 legislation that allowed these mine owners to keep right on making these violations with impunity. You have to show that you have true liability. You have to have a pattern of disregarding. But under the definition of a pattern of disregarding these violations, they have to have occurred. They have to have been official citations that occurred within the last 2 years. And these citations processes can drag on for many years so that it's almost impossible to rack up the requisite number of violations within 2 years. That's ridiculous.
But it's ridiculous, but we know it's ridiculous today because of what just happened. I mean, when the legislation passed, nobody sitting around this roundtable was writing a column saying, well, of course, if you read really closely, you can see the loopholes that people are going to be able to drive through.
Well, one wonders, though, whether the people writing them knew it or didn't know it.
Well, folks sitting around the table may not be people who report on mine safety.
This is true.
But in fact, there were many, many articles, in particularly in the West Virginia press, that have begun coming out about the number of violations that this guy and his mines were turning out. I mean, this guy, to a lot of folks, particularly in labor, but broadly speaking, was seen as something of a villain. I mean, to environmentalists, he was not a quiet operator. And one thing, to use another example than the ones Ross brought up, I would liken it a bit to financial crisis. One thing we do see here is how much of our laws rely on effective and forceful regulators. And we come into times, as the pendulum in different states or nationally shifts left to right, when sometimes we tell our regulators, you know, you're going to actually enforce this. You're going to make sure people follow this. And they have a lot of discretion to do that. And then sometimes it's easier to let our regulators let them slip by. Maybe we're getting a lot of campaign contributions from the operator of the mine or from Wall Street. And suddenly powers that they have go unenforced. They give warnings, but they don't actually put down penalties for violation. And this sort of thing happens. I mean, it's fair to say we don't always see everything as close as we did in retrospect, but we do make choices, and we could make them the other way, noting that tends to be that when we let our regulators off the job for too long, you know, bad things do often happen.
And these violations, the fines were so low, right, that it was much cheaper for them to keep on doing business as usual, meaning not very safely, and pay the fines and
but
not worry about it.
The other problem is cutting back on the amount of money given to support regulators. You cut back regulators,
right,
with budget cuts. You don't have enough people going into the mines to make a difference.
And one interesting thing about that I noticed is that, unlike a lot of coal mines, this, and I'm sorry I'm blanking out on the operator's name here, which I'm sure one of my co-panelists can remind me of, but these mines were totally non-unionized. And one reason that unions are particularly important in very dangerous jobs like mining is that they tend to be not only a politically organized but workplace organized voice for things that the workers are worried about, namely safety violations. And that has been a long-time role of unions, is why they were so important in industrial jobs. And his ability to do very, very aggressive union busting has protected him from having unions, but it meant there were no unions there to protect his workers.
You're talking about the Massey,
yes,
Energy Company. Mm-hmm. And you are hearing the voice of Ezra Klein. He's a columnist for The Washington Post and Newsweek. Melinda Henneberger, editor-in-chief of PoliticsDaily.com, and Ross Douthat, columnist for The New York Times. Do join us, 800-433-8850. The temperature is getting pretty hot around Washington, with a California man being arrested for making threatening phone calls to Nancy Pelosi. Hers is not the only threat that's been received. You've got members of Congress targeted with these kinds of threats, primarily over their votes on the health care plan, Melinda.
I think it's really frightening. There was a story in the Washington Post today that the number of threats to members of Congress had tripled in the last few months. And these are not people calling to say, I strongly disagree with your vote on health care. They're wishing them dead. They're horrible things like this Steve Cohen in Democrat in Tennessee, who was told if our Tea Party members had hoods, we would be burning your blank on a cross on the White House lawn. I mean, this is really vile, ugly stuff. And so when you have people, I'm sorry, like Sarah Palin saying, you know, don't retreat, reload, that sort of rhetoric has an effect.
Now,
and
go ahead.
No,
sorry.
I just find that really, it's an important time for Republican leaders, I think, to do what Tom Coburn did in the last week and say, you know, Nancy Pelosi is actually quite a nice person. In years gone by, we would have thought that was the most benign possible statement to make, just one Paul, you know, being polite as usual. Today, he's getting huge props for saying one of,
yeah,
his fellow lawmakers is a nice person.
What is fueling this kind of escalating, not only rhetoric, but acts of violence, Ross?
Well, I'm not sure we're actually seeing a real escalation in acts of violence. I mean, I think by the standards of 20th century American political history, even this highly polarized moment is not distinguished by anything remotely like the kind of real political violence you saw in the U.S. in the 60s and 70s, for instance. I mean, God willing, it'll remain that way. But I think it's important to note that there have been historically much more polarized and violent periods in American life. I mean, what's fueling it clearly is, look, this has been an extraordinary year and a half going back to the financial crisis in American life. And you began with a financial crisis that led to massive government investment to bail out Wall Street, basically, that was followed by subsequent massive government investment to bail out GM, Chrysler, and so on down the line. This was followed in turn by the largest stimulus package in American history, which was followed in turn by a massive piece of healthcare legislation. So you've had a series of extremely, one, polarizing pieces of legislation being passed, two, polarizing pieces of legislation that a lot of Americans perceive as fundamentally changing the way America does business. And I think that in this sense, the healthcare bill is sort of it became as controversial as it did because of everything that had happened before it.
You talk about the violence of the 60s, which was preceded by pretty strong rhetoric of the 60s, and that's what concerns me the most, Ezra.
You know, I do agree with Ross on one level that we don't want to overhype these things. But on the other, I think that one interesting facet of all this, and of course, you know, the legislation passing has an impact here, but so too, of course, does the deep, deep recession we're in. But there are, in other times, there have been elite bulwarks that at the very least saw part of their job as standing between these passions and you know, and the people they're directed at. One you could argue is the media. I think you have cable channels on both sides. If you look at MSNBC and Fox, both of which, you know, I go on occasionally, on any given night, they will be covering the same people. They'll both be covering Sarah Palin and the Tea Parties. And if you look at some of the leaders in Congress, like Mitch McConnell and others, they are not stepping up against this stuff. They're cheering them when they go and yell in the House chamber.
Ezra Klein of the Washington Post will be right back. Welcome back to the domestic hour of our Friday News Roundup this week with Melinda Henneberger of PoliticsDaily.com, Ross Douthat at The New York Times, Ezra Klein of The Washington Post and Newsweek. And if you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. We've just had an email from Rebecca at the University of Michigan wondering who pays for the rescue of the miners. Is it Massey Energy or is it the state of West Virginia? And I must confess, none of our participants seems to know the exact answer to that question. I'm sure one of our listeners will call in with the answer. And here's another. The real travesty in the coal mine disaster is that the whole issue will fade from national consciousness in a couple of weeks. Unfortunately, most Americans don't have a clue and don't care where their energy comes from, as long as it's cheap and reliable. It's too bad. The sacrifices that miners make are not known by more people in this country. Ezra?
I think it's true. I mean, we do not have a long memory on these things. And one of the difficult things in politics is, on the one hand, or for legislative politics, on the one hand, you want to do things right. And on the other hand, the room for action is so short. You see this in financial regulation, where you're going to get something much weaker, but they weren't ready to do it right after the crash. And I think you're probably going to see it here, too, that it is very difficult when an issue you didn't know much about creates a need for action. To merge the need to act quickly with the need to know what you're doing.
All right. I want to move to another issue, and that's the status of Republican National Committee Chair Michael Steele. Ross Douthat, is he in trouble at the RNC?
He is in trouble. I mean, the thing with Michael Steele is he's been more or less steadily in trouble since he became RNC chairman. I mean, the current scandal is a little different, because most of Steele's problems have been because of public gaffes, because basically he seems to see himself more as a kind of spokesman for the Republican Party than as a behind-the-scenes organizer, which is how the most successful RNC and DNC chairs have seen themselves. And so he's gone out on TV all the time and said stupid things. In this case, you have an actual, you know, it's small in terms of the dollars involved, but you have a scandal where the RNC...
A couple of thousand dollars
for an event involving young Republicans that ended up where they ended up going. They claim they didn't know it was a bondage-themed nightclub, which is what I say to my wife every Sunday morning, you know, so... at a time when the Republican Party is trying to raise high the banner of fiscal responsibility, and obviously it's the party of social conservatism, family values, et cetera, this looks very bad.
I'm back to my question. Is he going to lose his job over this?
I'll guess no.
Why?
Because I actually think, well, there are two reasons. One is that he's had relatively successful fundraising overall. Now, I think you could argue that any chairman would be a successful fundraiser in the current political environment, which is very favorable for Republicans. But to some extent, money does talk, and you are looking at a fairly impressive record of fundraising that isn't going to go away just because of this scandal. The other thing is that it's in a weird way, we seem to have entered an era where people just don't seem to resign. They do. Obviously, Eliot Spitzer resigned in sort of extreme circumstances. But you have, and part of it, I think, is there are so many different organizations.
How do we begin to define extreme circumstances? That line seems to get farther and farther out there. And Steele is now saying he's being held to a higher standard because he's a black man.
Yeah, I will say that I don't know that where he is at extreme circumstances. It might be wise for him to resign. It might be right. Someone like Senator Ensign, who has not only an adultery scandal, but you're now dealing with the way he paid people off, moving the payments into 12,000 increments, routed through his parents so that it wouldn't catch the IRS's attention. I mean, you're doing something with both a scandal and what looks like a possible illegality. And you might wonder why he hasn't resigned, and you're getting some questions in Nevada about that. But Steele, the question is, why doesn't he appear to be more embarrassed? You would see him resigning out of shame, not because he's driven out or worried about facing prosecution. And that doesn't seem to be happening. And nor do the elders in the Republican Party seem to be willing to say, either you stay off the TV or we get you out of here, but we can't keep doing this. We just have to stop. We look like amateurs.
Ashamed. He looks like he's having the time of his life. You know, he loves the microphone. And it's true that, I mean, the highlight of this guy's political career was the puppy commercial, you know, when he was running for the Senate in '06. And Democrats certainly hope he never goes away. I mean, really, he even though, as Ross said, he raised a lot of money for the RNC, the DNC did even better this time out. So, you know, at a time when Republicans are supposedly favored, he's even failing in that regard. And we in Politics Daily today had an interesting column, I thought, by Jill Lawrence saying, why doesn't Fox News do the right thing and take him on as a commentator? That would be a win-win for everybody.
Well, one thing you actually do see, to add on to Melinda's point, in the Maryland, I believe it's the governor's race, where Ehrlich is running again, if I have that right.
Yes.
The Democrat, the DNC actually has begun running ads saying, Ehrlich is a guy who made Michael Steele lieutenant governor. That was his judgment. Can you trust a man who promoted Michael Steele to anything? And so, I mean, at what point do Republicans say, you know, this isn't the way it should be going?
But this goes in a way to your complaint, Ezra, earlier about how elders in the various parties aren't tamping down on extremism. I think there isn't the same – the elders just don't have the kind of power they used to. You don't have a group of Republican senators who can walk into a room and say, all right, we're taking down Michael Steele tomorrow. You have so many overlapping sources of authority within the political coalitions now that – you know, what tends to happen instead is that big donors who are embarrassed by Steele, instead of pushing for his resignation, bypass him and go, you know, there are all these different sort of Republican and conservative startups where people give money. The Tea Parties have various forums to raise money outside the traditional RNC. And so in a way, Steele stays at the RNC. The RNC becomes less important and the establishment becomes weaker, and on we go.
And that's it.
And that's it. Decline of Rome.
Would the elders press for his resignation if they could, or if?
I think it's clear that leading Republicans have been embarrassed by Michael Steele for a while, and I think that the race issue does factor in frankly the opposite way than Steele thinks, that there is a unwillingness among Republicans to be perceived as pushing out their African American chairman, and Steele is playing this to the hilt.
And when he was chosen, it was seen as a smart move to counter Obama with an African American Republican leader.
And he was perceived as the sort of reform oriented,
relatively moderate,
et cetera. And
I would just add that one thing we should do is be clear about who the party elders are here. The RNC, like the DNC, the people who have control, are the chairman of the state parties, who are generally actually much more sort of grassroots-esque and oftentimes much more extreme than, say, the people who you would think of as being in positions of power in Washington. And so that has an effect on both who gets chosen and how their accountability works. Steele continues, as far as I understand, to have pretty good relationships with them and has done a good job sort of putting this as, you know, elite media is attacking me or I'm being held to a different standard. And so there's a narrative of resentment that may play better, you know, to folks who don't have as much of a direct concern about his national prestige as Washington Republicans would.
Let's talk about the U.S. Court of Appeals deciding a case involving Comcast and the FCC. What happened, Ezra?
So this is about the principle of net neutrality, which is to say that Comcast cannot decide that, you know what, YouTube is a big competitor or something, and we are going to slow down traffic that is going to the YouTube site. This had to do with BitTorrent, which was a file sharing service, sort of a descendant of Napster, for people who remember Napster. And there are a couple of interesting elements here. The one interesting political element, by the way, is that the D.C. Court of Appeals, which is a powerful court, has two vacancies, which Barack Obama has not yet filled. And a lot of people have been upset about that. They felt that this is putting them at a legal disadvantage. Liberals have been upset about that, felt it's putting them at a legal disadvantage. And though it would still have been a 6-5 decision probably instead of a 6-3 decision, which is what it was, you have more people. You have more of a chance to fashion a compromise that you prefer. So one thing that you're seeing is that, you know, the folks who believe in things like net neutrality are actually at a disadvantage on this court. And that's partially because the Obama administration has been very slow and very weak on nominations.
But it certainly leaves the FCC looking weak.
It does. I mean, but you could actually imagine a scenario where this decision comes back to hurt Comcast, right? Because as I understand it, you could imagine then some kind of congressional move that would actually, you know, that part of what the court said is that, right, correct me if I'm wrong on this, that the FCC just doesn't have the power, but theoretically could have the power to regulate Comcast more stringently. And you could imagine a congressional grant that would actually leave the FCC more empowered than even they were claiming they are right now. I think that's probably the thing that Comcast should be worried about, that they've won, but what's the fallout?
But what about this ruling and its effect on the merger between Comcast and NBC, Melinda.
I'm not sure what that will be. To me, one of the worst effects is that, you know, Obama, I think rightly, has been pushing to bring internet access to rural areas, and this is a setback for that, definitely.
I sort of agree with that, and I agree that you have a very dangerous situation when we the way these things work, when you're building infrastructure, which is fundamentally what Comcast owns when it comes to the internet, can also deal with use, right? It would be a little bit like if we had people, we had private companies building roads, and they were suddenly given the chance to say, you know what, we don't want Toyotas coming on our roads. Or if they are, they have to go at 42 miles an hour instead of 55. And of course, you could say a company like Comcast are competitive pressures. They're not going to want to lock Google out or something. So it'll all be fine. But it does get nerve-wracking. And it could be done in small ways. What it, you know, you could imagine a world in which it was harder to get to whatever the website will be that's against the NBC Comcast merger. You know, it's very slow when you try to load it on your Comcast browser.
it's interesting, though, that Comcast says it manages congestion not by network, but by volume.
Right. And so, you know, the long-time argument here, and the argument, to be fair to folks like Comcast, which you'll say, is that you have a universe of users. Primarily people are, you know, they're loading the New York Times or Ross Works.
One hopes.
Much more to the point, the Washington Post and PoliticsDaily.com. And, you know, and they are all being slowed down by these people who are downloading 100 movies every day at gigabyte levels. And so they're saying that you essentially need to somehow equalize the volume here. And if you just need to slow that down or make them pay more, that's fine. But there's a potential for abuse here.
Ezra Klein at the Washington Post and Newsweek. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's talk about this nuclear arms posture review that President Obama released on Tuesday. What's in that, Ross, and what kind of difference is that going to make?
It isn't clear that it's going to make that big a difference. I mean, the biggest change, and the one that everybody's talking about, it's somewhat ambiguous whether it's completely a change at all. But basically, it's a statement that this is sort of a mouthful, and I'll probably get it wrong, but that the U.S. commits to not using nuclear weapons in a retaliatory strike against countries that are signatories to the NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, if they are somebody can jump in and help me at any point. But the idea, basically the criticism is that it opens the U.S. to a position where a country could attack us with chemical or biological weapons, not nuclear weapons, and we would be committed to not responding with nuclear retaliation.
As I understand it, he said we wouldn't unless we did.
Well, I mean, right. No. That's the thing. It's couched in such a way
right.
that
he said unless it's so overwhelming that we decide to rethink
sure,
this.
But so, his opponents are arguing that this puts the U.S. in a far weakened position.
Opponents on both sides because, you know, you have the left saying he didn't go far enough, and as usual, the right saying this is really weakening and makes us a target.
Well, I think there are two things to say on this. One is that the sort of people who would be likely to hit us with chemical and biological weapons, you wouldn't really be great targets for a nuclear strike because it would be rogue actors probably dispersed across multiple states and so forth. So it may actually be a little bit less than meets the eye if we're talking about the nature of modern threats, particularly modern, modern terrorist threats. The other thing, though, is my understanding is you also have to look at this in terms of a larger strategic effort here. And my understanding of what the administration is doing is attempting to get a lot of people signed on to what appear to be very, very fair rules of the road as a method to isolate Iran. That a lot of what's going on here is attempting to reconstruct the rules of this such that it does not appear that the U.S. has tilted the game in its favor. And thus, those who refuse to come into the international framework look more intransigent, and it is easier to bring pressure to bear against them.
Right. And I think the legitimate critique then is not that this policy necessarily commits us to letting ourselves get attacked with sarin gas and not retaliating. I think the legitimate criticism is that there is in Obama's strategy on nuclear weapons a kind of naivete about the extent to which America's nuclear arsenal is a stumbling block to our non-proliferation efforts. And obviously, you know, people have different views on this. But I think you're right, Ezra, that there is a view in the administration that we would get more support from Russia and China, Brazil and Argentina, and so on, if we were perceived to be playing fair. And I don't, I think a lot of people, myself included, would argue that that's a very, very small part of the problem in terms of dealing with rogue actors
and
like Iran.
And what about President Obama and President Medvedev signing this nuclear arms control treaty?
I mean, I've actually, I've had that explained to me in very much similar terms, that Russia turned out to be, they turned out to be very negotiable with, and that part, that is also part of not just the treaty itself, which is important to the U.S., but that is also part of this effort to bring Russia, and more to the point, in some ways, bring China into this group. Because if you're going to get Iran, you are going to need pressure from Russia and China. They are, frankly, the vulnerabilities in the sort of international coalition here that Iran is best at exploiting for reasons of they want their natural gas, they're not that friendly towards the U.S. in some ways anyway. But that if they, if those two countries feel that the U.S. is actually playing very fair with them, giving them things they need, giving them things they can bring back to their people as diplomatic gets, then that it is easier for the U.S. to bring them on board on things like
Russia
and
Iran. And all you need is Senate ratification.
Right.
How likely
all you need.
Is that going to be?
Not.
Not? Do you think he's going to get it?
I think it's a tough situation this year with the politics of the midterm elections.
All right. We'll talk more about that and other subjects when we come back. Ross Douthat is a columnist for The New York Times. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy and the German Information Center, whose Germany.info publishes news about politics, culture, and lifestyle at Germany.info. By the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. And by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. The opposition takes power in Kyrgyzstan. The U.S. and Russia sign a nuclear arms reduction treaty. And China considers a change to its currency policy. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Just had word that Associate Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens, the court's oldest member and leader of its liberal bloc, is retiring. President Barack Obama now has his second high court opening to fill. Justice Stevens said Friday he'll step down when the court finishes its work for the summer, late in June or July. He said he hopes his successor is confirmed well in advance of the commencement of the court's next term. And, of course, that would mean prior to the November elections. That How important is that, Ezra?
It's pretty important. I mean, it is less important, to be sure, than if a conservative justice had retired or had to leave the court. But it will be quite a football. And one thing about it is that Stevens is very powerful on the court. He's the ranking, ranking justice, a chief associate, I think it's called. And he leads the liberal bloc and has a lot of respect as sort of the elder on the court. It is going to be very difficult for Obama to replace him with anyone of similar stature and, oddly, for a Gerald Ford nominee. Similar liberalism. You could have Obama replacing him with a more conservative nominee.
Oh, and you will. I mean, what's interesting, I mean, it's an interesting choice by Stevens, and it's understandable. One assumes that his thinking is you want your successor confirmed while the Democrats still have the largest possible majorities in the House and Senate, right? So yes, I mean, that is an advantage for Obama in getting the nominee through. The problem is the confirmation battles are going to happen in the heat of the midterm elections, where Republicans will have no incentive to cooperate, and Democrats will probably be very nervous about casting any kind of vote for anyone who's remotely controversial.
And the leading candidates to replace Stevens, Solicitor General Elena Kagan, she's 49 years old, federal appellate judges, Merrick Garland, who's 57, and Diane Wood, who's 59. Let's open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Indianapolis. Good morning, David. You're on the air.
Well, good morning, Diane. It's great to be on your show. You have a fantastic show. Look forward to it daily.
Thank you.
I'll get to my point real quickly. I wanted to just comment about the coal mine incident that's occurred. And isn't this just the same thing that's happened over and over again, where we tighten regulations, we tighten security, we tighten everything, and then over a period of time, we loosen it again. And regulators become friends with operators, and operators slip them a note, hey, can you let me get by on this one this time, and we'll get it fixed for you later, so on and so forth. And just like, you know, with even the Wall Street meltdown, the regulators got lax, and they allowed these things to go on, and then suddenly what we didn't think would happen happens.
And now everybody is apologizing on the Wall Street issue. And now I'm sure you're going to have the same thing with the mining issue.
How could we have known? Well, the thing is, too, since we just so recently passed this new safety regulation laws in 06, I think you'll have the argument, why pass more when we did all we could only a few years ago and it didn't help us any? So I think that'll be a major argument, too.
I think that's accurate. But, you know, it is one of these situations where you have to decide as to whether or not you want to address the exact dynamic that your caller is pointing out and say, you know what, regulators are imperfect. The times when they fail are the times when we need them
but
most.
But there have to be sufficient regulators. Let's agree on that.
That's right.
There do, but you can build regulations such that regulators are actually less important. To give one quick example, the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, our money and our banks is insured. It is safe, whether or not Ben Bernanke thinks that bank is doing risky things. It isn't that Ben Bernanke has the authority to come in and insure our money, or that Sheila Bair, who runs the FDIC, does. It simply happens. It is automatic. And interestingly, Alan Greenspan, who was the nation's chief regulator for many years, said before the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission yesterday, that, or maybe it was 2 days ago, that we should have automatic rules because regulators cannot see these crises coming.
Interesting. What seemed to be a little unusual about Ben Bernanke's testimony before Congress, he talked about the fact that Americans may have to accept higher taxes, may have to accept value-added taxes, which brought Republicans out of the woodwork screaming about higher taxes, Ross.
Well, yes. I mean, higher taxes are extremely, extremely unpopular. And one of the interesting dynamics is that not all higher taxes are unpopular, which is why the Democrats have traditionally campaigned on tax, not traditionally, but in the last 10 or 15 years, campaigned on tax cuts for the middle class and tax increases on the wealthy. And what you've seen, to the extent that taxes have been raised with the healthcare legislation and in other places, it's been that dynamic. It's been an attempt
to...
And it's not enough. No, it's not enough. You have a situation where you need to do probably some combination of middle class tax increases and spending cuts. But a lot of the big question facing the United States going forward is, which do Americans want less? Do they want they hate spending cuts and they hate tax increases? And so we're facing a situation where politicians have to choose, decide which is the lesser of two evils.
But they're also looking at Social Security. They're looking
Medicare.
At Medicare. What about the idea that has been rolled and rolled and rolled around raising the retirement age by 2 years?
It seems inevitable. And I thought that Bernanke's comments were just a statement of the obvious, that obviously we're going to have to choose between some combination of raising taxes and lowering these benefits. And that there was this outcry just proves how separated we've gotten so used to not hearing the truth from our politicians that this is a shock to hear this.
But the longer we let this go, the harder it is. Raising the retirement age will probably have to happen and won't do nearly enough.
One thing that
is very important to recognize here is that this is all being driven not by our current budget. It's a long-term question, and it is the growth in healthcare costs. That is what is behind this. So anything that simply raises taxes or simply cuts spending, you would wipe that out in a couple of years. You could cut $100 billion from the system, and then we have healthcare grow at 8% again like normal, and you're back there in a year or two. You're going to have to. There is no other choice here. Slow the growth in healthcare costs. If you don't do that, you cannot cut for long enough. You cannot raise taxes high enough. You will always find whatever you've just done wiped out because this system, which lies now at the center of our spending, is going up and up and up and up and up faster than you can cut or raise.
Right to Tom here in Washington, D.C. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Hi. Earlier you guys were talking about the threats, the increased vitriol that's been displayed toward Congress, including some pretty vile threats. And I think we can all agree that this is just, you know, this breakdown of civility is regrettable and wholly unjustifiable. And yet, I'm extremely frustrated because it seems that you folks have discovered the undesirability of this thing only when it's been directed against Democrats in the Obama administration. I don't remember all the hand-wringing and the bemoaning of this sort of thing when authors are writing novels about the assassination of President Bush and filmmakers were making false documentaries about his assassination and Harry Reid was calling President Bush a loser and a liar on the Senate floor. I mean, maybe you decry this sort of thing no matter who the target is and no matter what the source, but you certainly give a strong impression that you care about it only when it's directed against Democrats by Republicans.
Melinda.
I don't think it's fair to say that we would condone death threats against anybody of any party or persuasion. I think that Harry Reid had to apologize for those remarks, which did him no favors and no good for his political future. So I don't agree that we are selective in decrying this sort of rhetoric.
I'm a lot more sympathetic to the caller's point, as you might expect. I think that what we're seeing in the Obama era is similar in many respects to what we saw in the Bush era. And frankly, I'll be bipartisan about it, similar to what we saw in the Clinton era. I think that, you know, you had a level of right-wing vitriol against Clinton that was followed by an incredibly high level of left-wing vitriol against Bush that's been followed by an incredibly high level of right-wing vitriol against Obama. And I think if, you know, Mitt Romney is elected president in 2012, the pendulum will swing the other direction. I'm very skeptical of the idea that there is a particular sort of right-wing pathology that's driving this wave of death threats and so on. I think you saw very, very similar things in the Bush era directed
against
the president.
Did we hear about death threats then? I don't recall.
Well, one of the questions is, I think the caller's point is that you're more likely to hear about the death threats during the Nicholson Baker wrote a novel fantasizing about the assassination of George W. Bush.
Yes, but what you're not seeing here is coverage of signs. That isn't what brought this out. The Tea Parties were gone on for a long time. What you're seeing here is coverage of events. You have to be saying that the police who had to arrest somebody in Washington State for threatening Patty Murray with death were, you know, sort of liberal, you know, part of the liberal media here or something, or that the folks who are trying to track down threats made against Nancy Pelosi are part of this sort of liberal conspiracy. The question that we do have to face up to is, has there been a rise in actionable threats against public figures? Because that is something to worry about.
And when you talk about,
by the way, this is like what we saw in the Clinton years, which I think there's some truth to. You had a bombing of a federal building in the Clinton years that killed hundreds. I mean, I agree that you don't want to hype things, and you certainly don't want to do it in a political fashion. But if what we're seeing is coming from a law enforcement perspective is an increase in actionable suspicious intelligence, that is something to worry about and not just be poo-pooed.
To Tyler, Texas. Good morning, James.
Yes, ma'am. What I want to talk about was the mine accident. And first of all, I want you to understand that I'm not defending the mine operator at all, but many things have been said about IMSHA that are incorrect, and I'm not a supporter of IMSHA either, but many times people are talking about the 58 citations that the mine operator got, but no one talks about what those citations were. I work in the mining industry. I'm going to a mine right now. And many times what IMSHA does is, and I can't speak for the underground, we're not underground mines, but many times what IMSHA does is they misuse their power. We got a citation last week for striking a tool with a hammer, a metal tool with a hammer that was designed to be struck with a hammer. That was a violation, and we were threatened with an imminent danger citation if it was ever seen again. Well, that's pretty tough to do any work if you're going to do that. And so it's not that IMSHA, and there is no such thing. I'm not going to speak for the underground community, but from our perspective, there is no such thing as a coziness with the regulator.
James, thanks for your call. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Ezra.
Well, the one thing I'd point out on that is that at least in the case of this particular mine, about a dozen of the 58 violations had to do with methane buildup, which is, as I understand it, what insufficient ventilation and methane buildup, which is, at the end of the day, what caused the explosion. So I'm certain the caller is right that there's a lot of extraneous or strange regulation. But then we also have to be able to separate two serious violations.
All right. To Dickinson County, Virginia. Good morning, Matthew.
Good morning, Diane. I agree with your last caller. I also work in the mining industry, and I do work underground. And he was talking about your different violations. You have your minor violations, and then you have what they call S&S violations, which are your imminent danger. Ventilation is one of the largest things you do in your mines. And unfortunately, it is, in a lot of cases, up to the miners how they ventilate that mines. It's very difficult for the operator, and I'm not defending the operator, but it is difficult for them to go into every mine, every shift, and see how their crew is ventilating. You have a air control plan that tells you how to ventilate that mine. If you do not ventilate it properly, it does cause the buildup of methane. But something I haven't heard anyone discuss, there was also a temperature drop in that area. When the temperature drops, it raises the barometric pressure. When the barometric pressure raises, it forces methane into the face, making it more dangerous. And there was also seismic activity. When you have seismic activity and increased methane, if you have a rock, even a small rock, fall and spark, it can ignite the methane. And I do understand that they've had several violations due to ventilation. Some ventilation violations are minor violations, though, so they really need to look at exactly what it is. And the last caller said he is right. There is no real buddy system with IMSHA. They are very strict. They are there constantly. We've had IMSHA regulators at our mines. This past week, we've had probably 12 IMSHA inspectors, and that's been two per shift. So they are very strict, and there's a lot of things that can cause methane to ignite or can cause a buildup of methane.
Thanks for your call. Any comments?
Well, if as he describes, it's by definition very dangerous and very difficult to control. If you're having seismic activity, maybe you shouldn't have the mine open and people shouldn't be working underground under those conditions. I mean, if it's that dangerous that people could lose, 25 people could lose their lives, I'm not sure what's more important than
look,
that.
Coal mining is an incredibly dangerous profession. It's one of the most dangerous professions in the United States of America. And every day, coal miners make the decision to go into this incredibly dangerous profession because of, you know, and frankly, for economic reasons, because it pays very well. It pays very well comparatively.
And because they have very few other options in that
area. Well, they have very few other options that pay as well as, I mean,
exactly.
Coal mining pays you a solid middle class to even upper middle class, depending on how you define income levels. Levels wage. And yes, they do it because they don't have other options.
And they make the choice they want to put food on the table, but I don't know that.
Right. Well, but what you're saying is we need to, you know, well, it's important to close the mine in this circumstance and that circumstance and so on. Every time you say we're going to close the mine, you are effectively taking food off somebody's table.
All right, Ty, I want to ask you quickly about an email written in January by a former Toyota vice president supporting the government's case that Toyota knew what was happening very quickly, please.
Well, he was saying that we have to come clean, and he said this before the recall. And I mean, I just think it's unconscionable that isn't what happened and that they dragged their feet the entire way. I know people I have a friend who was in an accident like that, and she was made to feel that she was some crazy person who couldn't know the difference between the brake and the accelerator.
Melinda Hanna-Berger, she's editor-in-chief of PoliticsDaily.com, Ezra Klein at The Washington Post and Newsweek, Ross Douthat of The New York Times. As always, too much we didn't get to. Thank you all. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.